You're listening to a program produced in 2018 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud.
I'd like to open tonight with a quote from our guest author, Therese Mayotte. Crafting truth to be as bare as it feels was important. Memoir, for me, functions as something vulnerable in a sea of posturing. The most honest, authentic way to present Therese Mayotte and her powerful best-selling memoir, Heartberries, is simply to let her do it herself. Too often we search for descriptions and labels to identify something that moves us deeply, that shifts our understanding of someone or the world. Or we search for a way to frame a standout piece of writing when it deserves to and is worthy of standing as is, free of further linguistic attachments. Heartberries is Therese Mayotte's truth. I quote her, "I avoid the mysticism of my culture. My people know there is a true mechanism that runs through us. Stars were people in our continuum. Mountains were stories before they were mountains. Things were created by story." Her work is direct and poetic, with reflections on her native culture, on womanhood, on motherhood. Heartberries pulls us into her world and meditations and pushes against the presumptions, conceptions, and perceptives we all carry about writing, about trauma, indigenous culture, and truth. Therese Marie Mayotte is from Seabird Island Band in British Columbia. She graduated with an MFA from the Institute of American Indian Arts, has served as Saturday editor at The Rumpus, and was a columnist at Indian Country Today. Her writing appears in West Branch, Guernica, Pacific Standard, Elle, and elsewhere. She serves as faculty at the Institute of American Indian Arts and visits us tonight from Indiana, where she's a Tecumseh postdoctoral fellow at Purdue University. And fellow best-selling author Roxane Gay, whose bracing candor, vulnerability, and authority make her the perfect on-stage, in-conversation guest with Therese tonight. Aloud was honored to present Roxane last year, almost to the day, for her New York Times best-selling memoir, Hunger. Roxane is also the editor of the recently published anthology, Not That Bad, Dispatches from Rape Culture, author of the New York Times best-selling essay collection, Bad Feminist, the novel An Untamed State, and the short story collections Difficult Women and Aiti. She's a contributing opinion writer to the New York Times and has also written for ESPN's The Undefeated, Time, McSweeney's, The Nation, and many more. She's also the author of World of Wakanda for Marvel. A prolific writer and thinker, we give a warm welcome to both Roxane Gay, who will be joining us momentarily, and Therese Mayotte to the Aloud stage at the Los Angeles Public Library.
Thank you for being here. I'm going to read from Indian Sick. Casey, I want to be polite and present myself as decent. I know the math of regret and nostalgia. I regret leaving you, and I'm disappointed you let me go. I don't remember what I did. I know that I cried next to you. I was wearing lingerie. You were angry with me for wanting to die. More than that, you were upset that I was weak-minded. I was dramatic and unhinged. I couldn't placate. I know that's what I should have done. I wasn't stable, but men usually don't care about that. I didn't perform. I found myself uncovered and vulnerable in fabric so thin. I thought of everything I belted against my flesh and unclasped again and again. You used me. I know You think animals are sentient. You treat your dog well. I needed to talk to you. The way we operate asks a lot from me before I can ask something of you. This letter can spiral out of control like me, and maybe you won't read it because I might fail to send it, or you might decide your life without me is worth maintaining. You have white sensibilities, and who can fault you for being practical? I'd like this letter to be ashamed and wild like me, and I'd like to know you read it and wanted me more. I told the staff this is my journal. I'm going to die an Indian death. I want to lay my neck on the cool steel alloy of the train tracks back home. I want the death of a res dog. Mutts can't keep away from the tracks. I'm writing you from a behavioral health service building. I agreed to commit myself under the condition they would let me write. You should have thought before you made a crazy Indian woman your lover. Feel culpable in my insanity because you are partly to blame. I am not good, but you knew that. Why think less of me in here? You're so economic with your language and your time. I understand your frustration with me. You want to spare yourself any tax or energy, and I am acutely aware of my impulsivity. It might all be the same to you. Do you still love me? I still want you. Don't think less of me for being crazy. Don't think that I'm the only one culpable in my craziness. I was walking through the house in the dark. I had covered the windows and mirrors. I was just unseeing things, dragging my feet along the wood panels until I found myself in the kitchen. I could not forget the familiarity of the kitchen or its drawers and instruments. Keep in mind, you were once desperate for me. I need help, and I cannot stop thinking that every transgression has brought me closer to a light, a striking beacon that tells me death is absolution, and I have never chosen light. Do you consider me a transgression? I'm tired of the constant stories and the truth I don't acknowledge. They're not medicine anymore. I'm not medicine anymore. The words are flaccid, and the things I used to find sacred are torment. I'm stepping into my own undertow. My own valley is closing in on me. I curl into walls, ashamed at my cowardice. I am sick or possessed. The spirits used to possess the people. We called it Indian sick. And it was the first illness to be accounted for. It begins with want, with taking, and ends with the silence that hurts and makes us beg. There were stories about cures and causes. Women tried to eat soap berries or nothing and talked about how we all had it coming. When the first children died, it was too late to stop talking. When the beings took the women, they bound them in blood. They were buried in the wombs of sad memory. The only thing, the right thing, the thing that brought about our immunity was the knowledge that something instinctual would carry us back. The awareness that our ancestors were watching was vital. I don't feel the eyes of my grandmother anymore. What I feel struck with is something smaller in a less impressive world. I woke up today confused inside of something feminine and ancestral in its misery. I woke up as the bones of my ancestors locked in government storage. My illness has carried me into white buildings, into the doctor's office. And the therapist, with nothing to say other than I need my grandmother's eyes on me, smiling at my misguided heart. Imagine their faces when I say that. At the Behavioral Health Service building, I felt something. A young woman staring at me. She was soft-looking and crazy-eyed, sitting with an old gray wool blanket in her lap. Avoiding her stare was the first task I failed at the institution. "You're pretty," she said. "Thanks," I said. "No," she said, "thank you." Scared, I smiled and nodded. We both looked out of place, and when I considered what kind of woman would look like she belonged here, I drew a blank. "I got these moles," she said, and pointed to the five surrounding her mouth. "They're spitballs from Jesus." It was a mistake to check myself in. So many people said something wasn't right. I told them, "You are my savior, and this is what neglect can do." They didn't believe me. It's important to be loved back. No matter, I'm a mother. "My son will stay with a friend. Do this," they said. "Something is wrong. I know." We passed the hours in the waiting room watching the Weather Channel. We watched tornadoes and the fury of water wash around. Slowly, women were called in for assessment with psychiatrists, and then more women came in to wait. I was eventually alone on the couch, regular to crazy looking. I was somewhere in the middle, wearing an oversized petticoat and a two red lipstick. There was a glass where the workers observed us, and I recognized the man on the other side, Josue. Years before, we worked at a call center together. We had lunch a few times, and he told me about his night shifts at a hospital. He came outside and observed me in a quiet and careful way. Observation is a skill. Observation isn't easy, and the right eyes can make me feel like a deer, while the wrong ones can make me feel like a monster. He stood in front of me with a binder in his hand. "Therese," he said. He smiled. "It's good you're here." I said a lot of things to fill the silence. He didn't want to know why I was there. I told him every reason except the truth. He was kind of a dick in that it didn't matter what I said. He just smiled and sat with me for a moment and then went back to work. A nurse came in with a girl who couldn't have been more than 18. "Sit," the nurse said. "Calm your tits," the young girl said, turning to me. "Wild night?" The fuzz of the couch came off in my hand. The orange fur of it was familiar. A nurse came out of the gray door and motioned for me. I followed her into a room. She left me there with the door cracked. There was an urge to leap and run. The doctor walked in. She was petite and wore a blush hijab with a wine-colored lipstick. "On a scale of 1 to 10, how bad is your depression?" 7, I said. 7's not a 10, she smiled. "Why are you here? This is the last thing I can do. Do you have a plan to hurt yourself?" "It's dramatic. I don't think it's a real plan," I said. She sat up straighter. "I think things would be better if I was dead." She told me there was a better solution to pain and that she'd seen it herself. She asked me to stay for 5 days. I'd be out 2 days before Christmas. I had already bought my son's gift. I asked her if I could write. She said yes. I asked her if I would be out before Christmas for sure. She said yes. "Do this program for you," she said. The forms made me feel big. My signature mattered. I was signing a new treaty. The gamut of questions and searches through my bag lasted for hours, and during that time, several nurses pointed out that things do, in fact, get better. Thank you.
Hello. Hello.
Hey.
Wow, this is a nice space. I'm digging it. So what many of you don't know is that Therese and I work together at Purdue. And so we live in a delightful town.
Yeah.
What's your favorite part of Lafayette, Indiana?
It's not the Confederate flags, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I thought that could be a highlight for you, but I wasn't entirely sure.
Maybe, like, access to fresh corn, I guess, yeah.
And by access, what you mean is just being able to walk into the cornfield.
And just see it.
It's like, ah, I think I'll have 5 stalks today. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the corn is actually quite good. Sweet, juicy, tender.
Yeah.
Like corn, women. Yeah, it's all the same. No, it's not. Women are much deliciouser. New word. What else do you like?
Brian. You know Brian.
Yes, I do. Brian is our colleague.
Yeah.
Brian is nice.
Yeah.
Brian is like the oasis. He's the director of the creative writing program at Purdue. And he and I started at the same time. And,
Yeah, he's nice.
Yes.
He hosts dinners and he plants gardens. There's a lot of Trump voters, and my son is like bullied often just by Trump voters who think America is for whites only. Like they literally say that. So,
what do you tell him when he comes home from school with these stories? Because having lived in Lafayette now, well, I've been going back and forth for about 4 years, but it's rough to live there as a person of color. So, what do you tell him?
It's hard because you want to posit yourself as hopeful, but then the rhetoric of hopefulness has been weaponized against people of color, that we should be civil and hopeful and use radical love when we're being told to get out of the country. You know what I mean? So it's difficult. I think, honestly, I tried to let him talk because he's more forgiving than I am. Children are genuinely more forgiving.
Yes, I agree. I think it is really difficult, and it is interesting to see the way hope is being weaponized and where we're being expected to be civil, whatever that means, which it means following white people rules, and polite. Like Bernie Sanders came out and said that the Red Hen should not have denied Sarah Sanders service. And it's just like, what do you stand for? How do you find, hope isn't the word, but how do you find strength to continue on in a world where even the most liberal supposed allies are buying into this system where we have to play respectability politics?
Well, I think I know all about civility, like, because we were called savages, like natives were called savages, and, they cut our hair, they told us to stop praying, and they took away our ceremonies and our regalia, and it was to become civilized, and it was really savage, So I think I'm just resistant to any rhetoric that is obviously just a roadblock to being humane, I think there are ways to tell when somebody's being disingenuous or someone doesn't have the lived experience to even speak on the issue of, brown people shouldn't have to serve people who are putting kids in cages daily. You know what I mean?
No, we shouldn't. I mean, we should be able to fuck them up on sight.
We should be. I warm up the audience before I talk about weapons.
Yeah. I just like to dive right in.
No.
Like, let's just get dirty.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is an interesting time that we're living in, and it's an interesting time to be a writer because we have these books that we create that we have to promote, and the world feels like it's falling apart. So how do you focus on the work that you need to do when the world feels, and quite frankly, is coming apart at the seams?
I think it's coming apart at the seams because women like us haven't been given a platform to speak about the truth of our lives, and that our own history of, like women's history and indigenous history and black history has been erased, right? So I think it's coming apart at the seams because there hasn't been any attention to the our stories, you know, and the subjugation of a people who are not able to speak, you know, that can only last for so long.
Yes, it can. And now that we are finding ways to share our stories, it's interesting to see the kinds of resistance that is coming up and the resentment that we have these small opportunities to share our stories. And we're forced to speak even louder and resist even more, which can take quite a lot of energy. What do you do to restore yourself and to prepare yourself for each moment where you have to resist?
Oh, man.
I'm just here for the easy questions.
I found, okay, at Tippecanoe Cove, right? It's like it's a really sad water park with one slide
mm-hmm.
that you get on a tube.
Yes.
And has a little pool for like the kids.
Pool.
Yeah, and yeah. I go on the tube. And I just slide, you know.
It's rough in Lafayette. It's
no,
fucking rough.
Yeah, and like I take baths. A lot of it is water related, I mm-hmm. guess. You know, I find a lot of strength in just like knowing that if this was even 10 years ago, I couldn't afford to go to a water park.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for me, that restores my sanity. And then I think words do matter. When we get back out there and we start really provoking and talking and establishing ourselves, it really does change. It changes the rhetoric. It changes the mode. And I think one example is Me Too mm-hmm. or like a movement where we do have agency and we are speaking, you know?
Absolutely. And so you're touring your memoir, Heartberries.
Yeah.
And it's a very personal book, and as I'm sure you know, when you are a woman, and especially a woman of color, and you write personally, people tend to ignore the possibility that you might have boundaries. So, what has it been like touring this book, and how have you reinforced your boundaries in the face of this ignorance of boundaries?
I wasn't good at it. I just
wasn't.
I wasn't good at it until I started saying no. So, like, you know, after so many dates where I found myself answering questions, even at dinner with my friends, I wouldn't have answered. You know, because my friends wouldn't have asked me.
Right? Like,
yeah,
there are like, things my friends would never ask that strangers feel super comfortable asking.
Yeah. And I know sometimes it's coming from a place of love, like they've experienced trauma, so they're asking for some insight into something, but using your lived experience as examples. And I wasn't good. I let myself be whatever my publicist wanted or my publisher, who don't know me, right? They don't know my limitations. And I realized once I started telling people my boundaries, they were not exactly pleased, but at least they understood that was a limitation, whereas before they didn't know. And readers are understanding when you tell them, I don't have an answer. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know. But they, you know, I've heard people ask me why I'm still with Casey, you know? And it's like,
that's fucking bold.
I know. And then I like, if he was there, I would just point to him. You know, and, you know, and he does laundry. Like, he does a lot of things for me, like, that didn't go in the book. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But that's a question I still don't know how to answer. And I don't know that I know I should be asked, right? But I think we're in a culture where we're expected to perform and be interesting and polite as women writers.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? As I don't know where that came from. But
well, I'll give you one guess. Men.
Yeah. Yeah. But other women perpetuate it.
Oh, for sure. Like, I think a lot of times women play the game.
Yeah.
Where I'm going to smile and look pretty and play the role of the all-giving, no boundaries woman writer, because this is what I need to do to get ahead.
That's the other thing, is that I had been, literally, I was playing men out for money, right? Like, that was something I did in the past. And then I learned how to, in academia, it's the same type of hustle. You are invested in people you don't care about. You know, like, you're playing the game. And you let people walk all over you because you're at least making rent, you know. But then now that I'm established, I can say no. And I feel like that's so sad, because there are lots of women who can't. And if they do, they lose money, you know. And we do, too. I think we do, too.
We definitely do. But I must say, I think about that quite a lot in academia, in particular, when I look at what my adjunct colleagues go through. Mm-hmm. And the freedom that I do have with tenure, and the freedom to say no, to the freedom to have boundaries that I did not have when I was pre-tenure. And I just think, wow, there are so many people who do not have this freedom, who are eating so much shit just to pay rent. And quite frankly, who are not even making enough money for the rent. They're like rent adjacent.
Yeah.
And it's interesting and painful to see how many compromises people tend to have to make. And the more privileged you are, the fewer compromises. But it seems like for us as women of color, no matter what, we are still always making compromises. How do you reconcile that? Or do you?
I think now, I mean, the book is an assertion of power. The book is an assertion. The first line in the book is, my story was maltreated, which means when I was on the opposite side of the welfare desk, or when I was an adjunct, or when I was working at Red Lobster, people took my story, and being a single mom, they thought I was vulnerable, so they exploited me. Or like, they knew I was abused, so they abused me, because it makes more sense, you know, to pick on people who have experienced trauma, because we allow that more often than not. And so I think now that I'm, the book is an assertion of power, I actually feel powerful, and I don't compromise what I say anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't compromise my message. And I know that if somebody tries to hurt me, I can hurt them back and litigate or call the police. I mean, they might not believe me, but I could buy a lawyer. I could bail myself out.
Yeah, that is a great freedom.
Yeah.
Like, anytime I'm in an airport and someone gets froggy, I just think, well, I can bail myself out.
Yeah, yeah. And
whatever happens,
yeah,
someone's going to come and get me.
And that's power, because you know, okay, I can actually have a boundary, and I'm actually established to where if I am hurt, I can fight back, you know?
Do you like having power?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what to do with it. I'm still learning how to mentor, and I'm still learning how to, when I say things, people listen. I'm not used to that. And I don't know what to do with that. I kind of liked being invisible a little, especially because I was raised really radical. So I have a lot of radical ideas, you know?
There is a safety to being invisible. As powerless as you may feel being invisible, there's safety in that. But then when you are hyper visible, especially when you have a best-selling book and people do start listening to you, there's nowhere to hide.
And they could take it the wrong way.
Yes.
Like, I've seen a lot of people take the things you say wrong, you know?
They do. It's like reading comprehension.
Yeah.
What's going on?
Yeah, and people argue with me. People talk about me as if I'm representative for all Native Americans now.
You're not?
No.
Oh.
No.
Well, okay then.
And I think with power, though, now I rally to not be the only Native at the panel that I'm going to do. I rally to not be the only Native in faculty, right? So that's power.
Yes, that is important, and that is a good use of power, because it can be very isolating to be the only one and to be looked to as the spokesperson for all Native American women or all Native Americans or all Black women. I am the spokesperson for all Black women, yeah, by the way. But it can be really difficult.
Yeah.
Do you have a way you respond to people when they expect you to be the Native American spokesperson?
I say that my story is singular, and that, like, the spectrum of Native voices and our sovereignty, our tribal sovereignty, distinguishes us from each other, and that once people understand that, they can actually be more inclusive and intersectional, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
When you were writing Heartberries, did you ever worry about that reality, that publishing and the media would try to position you as the Native American writer? Because we've certainly seen it before with some, yeah, of your predecessors.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing is, like, because my story has, my father was a drunk, you know, my mother was many things. And I think I illustrate that well in the book. But to reviewers and people who interview me, they often relate those issues to the wider world and issues with Native Americans. So, like, I've seen people want to play up in features about me, play up that my mother used to be an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, no, that was casually mentioned in the book. It was never a real issue in our lives. And then the person who interviewed me said, well, but it's not untrue, is it? You know, because I was like, please take that line out. My brothers are going to be angry if, mm-hmm, you say my mom had problems with alcohol. She didn't. And they said, but it's not untrue, you know. And so we got into the semantics thing, and I knew that I wasn't going to win, you know. So they wanted a story about a poor Indian woman who had a drunk family. And I just, you know, I think in the text, I do a service to myself. I, mm-hmm, create myself. I'm dynamic. But I can't control how people frame me, you know?
Yeah, I do know. It's very difficult to recognize that, mm-hmm, that you don't have that control, because when you are putting such a personal story out there, you want to control how it's consumed and how it's understood, and you want to make sure it's not manipulated, which is, I think, this interesting and delicate tension when it comes to writing memoir.
Mm-hmm.
How did you determine what you were going to include and what you weren't going to include in terms of how people, thinking also about how people were going to perceive what you wrote? Did you think about that?
No, I wanted the ugliest parts of myself in the book. I wanted to be accountable because I suffered from postpartum depression, so I was not the mother I wanted to be in the past, mm-hmm, but I needed help. But I wanted to illustrate in the book what it looks like when a Native woman doesn't have access to health care and there's a stigma against mental illness and she's also poor, it becomes crazy making in and of itself, but you add on postpartum depression, you know, women, I was like going into psychosis, right? So I had to write the ugliness of what that looks like up close because I want that to be written for other women who have experienced that, you know?
Is there one thing you want the reader to take away from this book?
I think that our stories matter, as cliche as it sounds. That, like, nobody should feel that their voice is unwanted or unnecessary in the world, you know? And that even if you are, you know, nobody, right? If you're a single mother on welfare, that is, you can become a New York Times bestseller.
Yes, you can.
You can, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So you talked a bit about mentoring. What does mentoring look like for you?
I think I've experienced a bad side of mentorship, you know, in my life from men, right? And then I experienced a good side of mentorship with you and Lydia Yuknovich and Pam Houston and women who want you to feel that you can talk to them. And I think mentorship in a lot of ways is a type of sisterhood of, like, protection, that, like, we experience something very unique in a writing world from the way we're represented to the way we're treated at events. And that the stronger that mentorship becomes, the more we're protected.
Absolutely. The mentorship I've received has been some of the most protective and invaluable support that I've gotten. A lot of times people think it's the adoring crowds and the lovely events, and that's wonderful. Mm-hmm. But it's the support I got from other writers to help me prepare for it, for the emotional impact of being on stage and making mm-hmm. myself vulnerable night after night. And just handling having a book about myself out in the world that has been really helpful. Do you find yourself mentoring other writers now?
Yeah, especially like women writers, and not just young women writers, but women writers who are writing about sexual violence right now, where, they understand how people are dismissive or exhausted by that content. But they know how to make it art, you know? And I'm mentoring women. Ariel Robbins is somebody I'm mentoring right now. And I think her book is amazing, you know? And, you know, I think it's like, you know, for me, I try to bring people in as much as I can, you know?
He said something really interesting that I've been thinking a lot about, and that is taking trauma and making it art, mm-hmm. the telling of it art. How do you do that? What do you think are the key things that writers need to do? Because oftentimes people send me their writing to look at, mm-hmm. and it's generally about trauma. And I get why, because I've written about it.
Yeah.
But I have to oftentimes tell them, this is testimony, and it's heartfelt, and I'm sorry for what you've been through, but this is not craft, and it's not an essay.
Yeah,
it's not yet for public consumption. And so for you, what are some of the guidelines that you offer in terms of taking trauma and making it art?
Well, when my father died, I was in bed, like hungover. Somebody called me and told me he had been murdered. And that's when I knew that I had unresolved issues with him. And I knew that he had abused me. I didn't want to admit how, you know? So what I wrote down was really bad writing. What I wrote down was that all I have left are pictures of him drunk, passed out. All I have left are like thinking of him when it's raining. And that was bad art, you know? It was cliche. And it was also testimony. And then I reduced that down. And after 6 years, I started the line, my father died at the Thunderbird Hotel on Flood Hope Road. And it was because I had to process. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of time to read your work, give it time, think about it in terms of art, and reduce it down to the most powerful and poignant lines. You know? Yeah. The best illustrations.
Yeah. Distance and finding those key moments.
Yeah.
They do go a long way. How much distance, you said it took 6 years mm-hmm. to be able to write about your father. How much distance did it require for you to write about your relationship and your childhood and your motherhood, which is such a key part of who you are?
I think I was writing about that from even as it was happening, you know, like journaling and things like that. So I think it was a practice of language, right? Mm-hmm. Like even to say, you know, I was abused by my mother. My mother neglected me. Mm-hmm. Like even to say that emotionally was very difficult. But I knew if I wanted to illustrate it in a book, I would have to present her as dynamic so the readership would know that I loved her, and that made her transgressions against me even worse, mm-hmm. that I loved her. You know, so illustrating that love was important, you know. Yeah.
One of the things I admired most in Heartberries, which I read about a year ago, and it's stayed with me since, was the nuance that you could say, I love my mother, and she neglected me.
Mm-hmm.
And to be able to have those two things be true at the same time. Did it take a long time to get to a place where you could let those two things be true and to say them, or was that something that was just always there?
I think deep down it was always there. You know, when somebody hurts you, I think it's really immediate to vilify them.
Mm-hmm.
And then the worst part is when the wave comes over you that you were betrayed because you trusted them.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's that part that is, I resist forgiveness, right? Like the rhetoric of forgiveness. But I believe there is a third part of that when you've been abused or traumatized, where you have to reconcile mm-hmm. just to be able to get out of bed, you mm-hmm. know? So part of the reconciliation was to admit that I still loved her, mm-hmm. that I still wanted her love, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a really courageous thing to do. And it's a difficult thing to do, to admit that you have that need and, more importantly, that desire.
Yeah.
Because oftentimes when we talk about desire, people get uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Like, oh, don't want too much. Control that want.
Yeah.
And to just let it all out, I thought was a very brave thing to do on the page.
Yeah.
Do you mind being told that your writing is brave? Or... I guess, how do you respond to that?
My writing might be brave, but I'm not brave. I'm actually, you know, I don't, you know, that's why I write. Mm-hmm. It's because I'm not brave.
I agree. Yeah. I'm the same way. People always tell me I'm brave, and I'm like, you don't know me at all.
Yeah.
So I'm like, afraid of spiders.
Yeah, so everything in the book about the desperation for a man and then realizing it wasn't about the man, it was about that I needed to heal myself and be autonomous and have agency and do something for myself. Those were things that I came to on the page. And in real life, I was a mess and not brave and not defending myself, but clearly on the page I'm angry, you know? Yeah.
How do you do that? Find the strength to be brave on the page, even when you're not brave in life? Or is it because it's on the page that you can do so?
I didn't think anyone would read it. So
we are so much alike. I love telling myself that. I'm like, girl, no one's going to read it. Say whatever you want.
This,
Whoops.
Yeah. And I think that's like guilelessness or like risk is if what am I doing if I'm not writing the thing, the mm-hmm. most brutal, and it's not even brutal experience. It's the thing I don't want to say that I'm scared to say, mm-hmm. you know?
Have you lost any of that guilelessness or that sense of risk now that there are expectations for whatever you do next?
Not on the page.
Good.
Yeah.
Very good.
I think I'm more polite now because I'm visible. Mm-hmm. Whereas before I was like, people were like, you know, they didn't, I don't know. I acted up a lot, you know, and
you
now.
You seem like a nice girl.
Yeah, I'm a nice girl now.
What are you working on now?
I'm working on essays about like murdered and missing Indigenous women, but relating it to the fact that I'm in proximity to women that I know and love who are missing, you know, and trying to, it's not a personal text, but it's personal in the cause, you know? And I'm working on an essay about Indians and tragedy, how we're fixed in tragic narratives and how do we move away from that or how do we deal with that as authors. And I'm also working on an editorial about the fact that like the civility is really disinteresting to a Native American. Yeah.
Yeah. Those are all actually really great. I can't wait to read all of them.
I just need to finish.
Yeah. That's the problem. It's the small detail about the writing process is that once you start something, at some point you have to finish it.
No, but yesterday, okay. So I've been reading Hunger again, right? Mm-hmm. So like, but in your acknowledgments, you acknowledge Law and Order SVU or Law and Order in general, right?
No, SVU.
SVU?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I watched the Law and Order with, Vincent D'Onofrio?
Yes, Criminal Intent.
Yeah.
Also worthy.
And I think that helps you just get through the first draft.
It really does.
Yeah.
In fact, that's what I spent my afternoon doing.
Me too.
Watched Law and Order. And
Law and Order?
Made dinner for someone. And I watched SVU, even though I saw Criminal Intent was on Wii or one of the other networks. And I was
No.
But I was watching a really good SVU. And so I was torn.
The best line today in all of the episodes I watched was when Vincent D'Onofrio looks around the room and he says, "This is a kill room." And I was like, oh, this is good. Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't even know what was going on.
I even know which episode. Because the kill room is a freezer like type place in the back of this guy's business, and there are these two cousins who take their murder victims. I'm sad that like that one line, I can give you the whole episode, but it's a really good episode.
And the end of the episode is the woman was behind it all along.
Yep.
She was the mastermind of everything. Yeah. That's a good,
which is, I love that twist. And she's a recurring character in about four episodes.
I like that.
It's always good when women get away with murder.
I know.
It doesn't happen nearly enough. Yeah. So what are you, let's talk about some good things. I mean, not everything we've talked about is good, but let's talk about some more lighthearted things. What are your favorite shows on television right now?
You know, I used to be into the 90 Day Fiancé, but I think it is too depressing now.
I was just talking about that on Twitter about a week ago. Oh,
yeah. I watched all the old seasons. Mm-hmm. And let's see. Okay, so let me see. What am I really hooked into? Pose on FX is really good. And I was watching My Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. And then that ended the last season. And let's see. I watch too much TV. So, like...
Who among us?
I watch Jersey Shore.
The reunion?
Yeah.
Oh. By the way, you saw that poor little baby and Ronnie and his wife or girlfriend are fighting. And now a friend of the couple has the baby.
That's crazy.
And the wife is in jail because she beat him and dragged him with the car.
Yeah. But... what Ronnie posted on Instagram, it looked like he was beating her.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not crying for Ronnie.
No, nobody's crying for Ronnie.
I think domestic violence, regardless of the perpetrator, is bad.
But it is a messed up situation.
Yeah, they're just toxic with each other.
Yeah.
And it's not good at all.
But in the way that he's portrayed in the MTV show, is they actively show him as a mess. But they don't show the damage he does to women.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even with, like, Sammy's sweetheart, right? In the old episodes.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, it was
they're
very
all
selective
Me Too's,
editing.
By the way.
Yes.
Like, Ronnie, the situation. They were all, like, really horrible men.
Yes, they were and are.
Yeah.
I don't know that they've had some sort of grand evolution over the past 10 years or so. I don't know that they've learned a goddamn thing.
The production is different. The production is more informed.
I haven't watched it yet because I've been busy with Floribama Shores.
Oh, I haven't watched that.
Oh, it's so bad. It's even for me, I was like, this is utterly meritless, but in a really compelling way.
I like that blonde.
Yeah.
She's funny.
They're hilarious, and they like... as white people are wont to do, they walk barefoot everywhere. And I saw a person on the airplane walking barefoot to the bathroom. So just marinating in someone else's DNA. And so that Floribama Shores makes me think of that. It's so good. It's so good. And by good, I mean bad. But good again.
No, I feel like talking about pop culture, even... you know, writing about it. Mm-hmm. I think we should be given more space to do things like that.
I agree.
Because often when we're solicited to write, it's about trauma or...
Roxanne, a black thing just happened.
Yeah.
I
think able to just write about SVU.
Absolutely. And it's interesting. The more success you get, the more you can say, I would like to write about something that is not tied inherently to my identity, even though pop culture is tied inherently to my identity. That's me. There's no there. But it is frustrating to have this expectation that all you care about is the struggle. And I think it ties back to that essay you mentioned that you're working on about that the Native story isn't only grounded in tragedy. Because I think for any marginalized community, there is this predominant narrative that our story, whether it's queer people or black people or trans people or women or people of color, that our story is about tragedy and suffering. Yeah. And yet we rarely have time to talk about joy. When we do talk about joy, people criticize it. Like, people were criticizing Black Girl Magic and Black Boy Joy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, really? Like, the one time we're talking about something happy, that people are like, oh, I'm not Black Girl Magic, so sit down.
No, I think the thing is, it is it's a colonial thing where all of our identities are based in the struggle, mm-hmm. like the struggle. And that, but what about before colonization? Mm-hmm. And what about before when we were the brief moments where we're able to inhabit our bodies without thinking about the struggle?
Absolutely.
You know, and I think those need to be illustrated and talked about because those are sources of like a how-to in resistance, mm-hmm. you know?
And also the after, like that we in many ways thrive despite colonization. Words. Mm-hmm. We need to be able to have space for those stories as well, that despite your best efforts, we are still here mm-hmm. and we are still creating things and we have diverse and, as you say, dynamic stories to tell. We are dynamic people. Do you find it important to extend yourself beyond what people want you to do and write about, for example, Jersey Shore, the reunion, which I would pay good money to read you on.
That's the thing. It's like I want... The other thing is the pressing issues sometimes override our joy, mm-hmm. like when it comes to our work. So like, you know, something... That's something I could incorporate in my book is like talking about pop culture and... but in the real-time daily thing of my life, there seems to be always a pressing issue that, like, people want you to weigh in on or people need you to rally for or defend, right?
Yeah, it's actually pressure in many ways to have these things you want to write about and then these pressing things that you need to write about mm-hmm. or that people think you need to write about. Mm-hmm. It can be really difficult. Well, I could ask you questions all night, but I know that there are questions in the audience, and so we would love to take some questions from you. There are people running around with microphones, so throw your hands up.
On?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, couldn't tell. So my question is sort of about the trajectory of your formal education. And so in the bio that got read, the woman said that you started out going to some schools where the predominant culture was Native American, and now you're at Purdue doing your postdoc. And I wonder if you would reflect on the benefit of starting your education in a place that was familiar and comfortable and then moving to a mainstream place. And the context for the question is, you know, there aren't schools for just South Asian people in America to learn creative writing or to study. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've been in pretty offensive writing rooms. And I just wonder if you felt some benefit from having that process for yourself.
Yeah, when I was doing my MA, I was attending a university, and they wanted me to take MFA courses there. And so I experienced the white MFA, right? Which, I mean, there were times they read my work, which would have, like, a very gluttonous or, you know, sexually gratuitous, like, female protagonist who was also indigenous. And then they would assume that she was a prostitute. Or they would assume, like, she's that way because of X thing and, like, relate it to a racist ideology about Native Americans. Or when I would talk about the reading list and the necessity for, like, quote-unquote diverse voices, right? That, like, I understand Flannery O'Connor is a wonderful author. I would just like for the syllabus to incorporate voices that are like me, because I want to see how do you do that, right? And so that, it was a little demoralizing, right, to experience the fact that when I was in workshop, I was the only Native there. And when I got to the Institute of American Indian Arts, it did feel like a renaissance, you know? And I think there was there's something so powerful about being around people like you who are also trying to write. I think there's something really profound about that. But then I think it prepared me for something like Purdue, where I know that I'm typically the only native in the room. But I can't say how it's going to go, because it's going to be I've only been there for a year, you know? Yeah. Ask me in like two or three, you know? Yeah. Thank you.
Hi. You mentioned that you were raised in a radical environment and that you were radical. And that tweaked my interest. What exactly did you mean when you talked about that, when you described yourself that way?
Yeah, my mother was part of the Red Power movement, which incorporated food programs and shelters. It was like the resurgence of culture as well, and sobriety as an avenue of resistance. And so she worked in a group home. She worked in a shelter, Crabtree Corner, and she also protested all the time. So what we learned is that was the norm. That was how we engaged with the world. And I was just telling a story at lunch about how she pulled me out of school. I wanted to read Mark Twain. I did. But she pulled me out of school in third grade because she didn't want me to read Mark Twain if Frederick Douglass wasn't going to be incorporated or another black writer. So she pulled me out. And it was embarrassing, but I'm glad she did it, because I think it started a conversation, you know? Yeah. Thanks.
Question over here. I'm wondering, given the national political situation, whether you, as successful writer, feel a pressure to be political.
I think no matter what I do, it's political. You know, I think the story of my life about sexual violence and trauma and poverty and what that can do to a family, I think that is political. And I made sure it wasn't rhetorical. I made sure that I didn't position myself as just, or that I was an authority. But I think that in and of itself was political, yeah.
And I would say the exact same thing. As a black woman, to write is political. As a black queer woman, to write is political, particularly when literacy was banned mm-hmm. during slavery. Every time I write.
Yeah.
Next question. So you both wrote deeply personal books, and I'm curious, after the publication of those out into the wild, what single experience or multiple experiences stick out as just surprising you after that happened?
Do you want to go first? Could you go first?
You know, it's interesting. Hunger has been out for a year, but in the past, and it's been buck wild that whole time. But in the past couple of weeks, people have really lost their minds and have just transgressed all decency. The other day, a man emailed me and said, "How does your hubby have sex with you?" And so people, and he wasn't being like, it wasn't a troll. He was genuinely asking this question. And I was like, first of all, I'll let her know that you have this question. But it's just that sort of desecration of decency, that because you are a woman of color in the public sphere and you have written your story, people think they can ask you anything. And I'm pretty unflappable, but I must say that one threw me off my game, because I was so stunned at the impropriety of it. And it's things like that. And also people on the other end of the spectrum, people thinking we're best friends because they relate so much to what I write. And I don't want to disrespect that, but you don't know me. You know what you read about me in a book that was extremely disciplined and extremely controlled. And I'm actually a private person. And so it's that sense of familiarity that has been the most surprising.
I think, so I was surprised at the success. So I was on The Daily Show, and then The Daily Show, yeah, and you were on The Daily Show, and they posted the video on The Daily Show Facebook page, and I read the comments. I shouldn't have read the comments.
Oh, girl.
And so Trevor Noah asked me, how could you remember being abused, right? And I think for anyone who's experienced trauma, you know that there's going to be gaps in years and that you can actively forget. You can force yourself to forget. So I talked about how I mitigated until it became untrue. And then one of the first comments was, I don't believe her. You know, and I expected that. I expected them to question my story. But I was surprised that, like, I was surprised that it's that quick, you know, that people are so quick to not care about another person, right? Yeah.
Yeah, the immediacy of cruelty is something. Yeah. It really is.
Yeah, because that's not my first go-to, you know.
Yeah. And I'm no saint. So, like, it always surprises me how quickly, and we're seeing that quite a lot now. I tend not to be an alarmist about current events because mm-hmm. people, like, just looking at history, this is not, and in fact, the worst things have ever been. But there is a lack of something, a lack of generosity, a lack of patience, a lack of kindness, which is not to be confused with niceness, which I don't believe in. Mm-hmm. And it is challenging to negotiate and to see, like, if you had told me 5 years ago the breathtaking cruelty that people would subject me to for daring to have an opinion, mm-hmm. I don't know that I would be doing what I'm doing today. Like, if I knew in advance, I'd just be like, no, thanks. I'm good. I'll just keep teaching.
No, I just keep thinking it is better than working at Red Lobster.
Yeah.
Because I work there, I know. Yeah.
Yeah, I've bartended. It's better. Ish? No, it is better. It is. Yeah. I love my job, but like the price is high. Like,
yeah.
But also the compensation is good. So it evens out, but it's difficult.
Mm-hmm. I refuse to answer this question if it's too personal. But I'm just curious, now that people are listening to you and you're still people, how do you decide who to trust in your life? And has that changed from before people were listening to you?
I think I was eager to trust people. I still am. I don't know if I like getting hurt, but it feels like my friends probably think that. Because I instinctively want to trust people. And, you know, in spite of the advice I get from other people to be careful and calculated, I know that I'm no good at that. I like to love people, you know. And I like, you know, when they disappoint me, it's difficult. And I think, though, the whole purpose of my existence is to feel polarity, to like feel things. And if I was too guarded, I wouldn't be able to exist in the extremes that I feel. And I like the high, you know, I like loving people and trusting them. And when it's good, it's really good, you know?
Yeah, I'm the opposite. My best friends today are the people that were my best friends before anything successful happened to me. Which is not to say I haven't made lovely new friends. I have. But if you look at my original crew, like the crew I hang out with now that I correspond with and the people I'm actually talking to online, it's the same people I was talking to and spending time with and getting down with 10 years ago. Because they knew me when I was submitting work to Word Riot and thrilled at an acceptance, and I frankly would still be thrilled by that. And so I know that there's no agenda there. And I know that, and it's funny, we were just talking about this before I came over. Like, I was just saying, you keep me grounded. Like, they keep me grounded. Mm-hmm. And they're willing to take me to task when I'm wrong. And oftentimes people who perceive you in a certain way or as having a certain amount of power are unwilling to hold you accountable. And that's why you see, I'm not famous, but that's why you see famous people getting into a lot of problems, because they don't have any friends who will say, you are wrong and you made a mistake here. So the people I trust most are the people who will say, you are wrong when I'm wrong, and who will also give me compliments when I need them.
I think the sad thing, because like I'm really open, but the other thing is I haven't made any new friends. Like, nobody wants to be my friend. So.
I'm your friend.
Yeah, because I'm traveling, you know, you don't have time to get to know.
It's super, super hard. That part is also true, because, and we were talking about this backstage, publicists don't necessarily think of the human factor of being on the road, and people think it's really wonderful. In some ways it is, but like when you're gone 100 nights a year, it's exhausting to be in a different city once or twice a week, sometimes more. And after an event, you're emotionally drained and the signing line can take quite a long time. And so you don't really have time to hang out and socialize and have drinks and meet people. So
I guess
that is the other reason I have the same old friends.
Yeah. Because I have the same friends in New York. Because I did that whole thing. You read, you do the thing. I ate beef jerky for dinner, and I went to bed alone. Because I didn't want to go out and eat alone.
Yeah, it's hard. I do a lot of hotel restauranting.
Yeah.
Because I'm on the road so much, I've had to force myself to leave the room, because sometimes it's just like, I can't do room service one more day.
Yeah.
And that's sad, because I love the idea of room service.
Yeah, the idea is great.
Like, just bring it to me.
Yeah.
And then take it away. The future is amazing. Yeah, down here in the front row. Oh.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, thank you.
So I know you all talked a lot about how it's really hard sharing personal narratives. So I'm wondering, what's the joy in sharing and being vulnerable in your work? Because I really appreciate both of you sharing yourselves, but what's the joy in doing this?
I think the readers, right? Like, when they come up to you and they like talk about, and this is not what I desire from all readers, right? Is that it touched them and that they really care. Like when I read in Santa Fe, men came up to me crying because they wanted to be that vulnerable. And I thought, well, this is pretty much why I'm doing it, is because I really wanted to share my experience with one other person, and I wanted them to understand, and I wanted to illustrate my life to them. And so that's the thing that I like. I do like traveling. I really like being in LA. I wouldn't experience this if I wasn't a writer, you know? Yeah.
I would agree with the readers, and the most unexpected joy of this entire writing process, because I never thought I would write about myself. That's not a thing I ever thought I would have the ability to do, has been hearing how people are impacted by my work, because I write for myself first and foremost. So I never anticipated how people would receive it. And to see that people are actually helped by just little old me and my words is gratifying in an unspeakable way. It's like, okay, no matter what happens in this life, I did one good thing. I helped one fat woman feel stronger in her body and feel seen. I helped one rape victim feel less alone. I helped one man recognize that he needs to treat women better. Whatever it is, like, to know that my words did that, it's an immense joy.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that really kind of touched me was the idea of mentorship and how mentorship can lead to sisterhood, a really strong sisterhood. And I work in education, and even within K through 8 school, sometimes there is a lot of, like, it's really competitive. And I yearn for that sisterhood, that mentorship, within education, because I plan to stay within education for the rest of my life. How can I help be a part of that or help create that?
I think in a room sometimes you see the searching eyes and you see somebody who appears vulnerable or is scared to talk to you because they're impressed that you're a woman who has it together, right? And I actively go up to those people and talk to them, you know? And sometimes you, it's very organic for me. It's really natural because they're usually drawn to me, right? And I usually know if I can help that person or if I'm not going to be a help to that person. Because there are some people, you know, who don't want to talk about craft. They want the mentorship, the emotional mentorship, but they can't deal with critique. And like, so it's like you have to find the right partnerships, you know?
Yeah, I would agree with all that. No, it's really true because some people want therapy.
Yeah.
And I'm not a therapist.
No, I'm not a therapist.
So I wanted to ask about like current events and especially the recent announcement that Justice Kennedy is retiring from the Supreme Court and how, well, because in my place of work, there's as soon as we heard that, there's such a sadness in the air. And I just wanted to ask about like how we can not like have the urge to just scream into the pillow all day long. Like how can we like rise up and like like actually move past this, like move forward.
That's a really good question. And I think it's a question that a lot of us are grappling with right now because things were bad. And then Kennedy retired like a fucking coward. He did. It's just unfathomable, like what a loathsome cur he is to retire now and give Trump another pick, especially when he's younger than RBG, who is like, fuck you. And bless her glass of wine a day and working out and whatever else, like prayer circle, like whatever we need to do to keep her going. And I mean, the thing is, she deserves retirement. So it's grotesque that he retired, but whatever. I think that joy is resistance. And one of the things I noticed online yesterday was hysteria. And I think we have to resist giving into that. We have to resist retweeting these hysterical tweets about the end of the world. And we have to stop responding to men like Brian Stelter, who says we're not three steps away from The Handmaid's Tale because we're like one. You know, like nothing good is going to come from that, even though if that's your process, I respect it. But for me, I just decided I hadn't been online in a week and I just decided today, I was like, you know, I'm aware of what's going on in the world. I am stunned by it. I'm ready to fight, but I'm also going to live my life. And I think we have to all find the balance between resistance, fighting, and living. Because when we don't, we give them what they want. And life does go on, though for poor women, life is about to come to an end because, God, I don't want to believe it, but we're so close to losing Roe versus Wade again. And it's poor women who are going to be affected, poor women from all walks of life, not rich women, because we can go wherever we want. We can fly to any country we need or any state, but poor women can't. And so what I'm trying to do is give money to abortion funds and give money to Planned Parenthood. And to now I'm really reading up on my local candidates to figure out what's happening at the local levels and at the state levels, because the federal level is a shit show and we can't do much there, but we can do a lot at the local level and then trickle upward into making it less of a shit show in November. And then, of course, in 2020, the key thing I want everyone to really be thinking about is, what do we do to get Trump out in 2020? Right now, we don't have a good answer to that question, and I think more people need to face that. Like, we don't have a single valid candidate yet who can run against, and more importantly, beat Trump, who's not 900 years old. And so what are we going to do? Like, we need to have a response, and it needs to be now, not in 2020, and like thinking about 2024. I don't want to think about 2024. I want to think about now. So I think we just have to be aware, and we also have to take time, like, away from it. Like, it's okay to say, I can't do this right now, or I need to scream in my pillow right now. I did some pillow screaming yesterday because I was just like, first I got an email saying no justice is retiring because that was the first news story. And then that motherfucker was like, yeah, haha, I'm retiring. And so I did have a moment where once it sunk in and I realized, oh, shit, the union thing is bad, but like 6% of Americans are in unions and 52% of Americans are women. This is worse. And so I screamed and I let myself have that moment. And then I just realized, okay, let's move on. Like, we're going to have to just do something about it. So just find the balance. I'm a Libra. Sorry. Yeah.
You know, everything you said, I think for Indigenous people, as far as like The Handmaid's Tale, like, we were already dealing with those things. We were already dealing with the type of exploitation that is in the series. We were already dealing with them basically coercing or outright restricting our rights to be mothers, right, and to be parents. And, you know, I think that was recent. That's in the 70s and the early 80s that women were realizing that they couldn't have children because of what a doctor did without their consent. So, like, you know, and if we look at how Indigenous people have been treated, we've experienced the worst of it, right? Or not even, not to categorize it at all. It's just that we've also been resilient and survived, and we're still here, and we still have carried traditions and ethics and value systems, and we also know the beauty of our culture, that we started irrigation systems, that we brought medicine, that we have done beautiful things. So I think that helps me not scream into a pillow, is that we carry on, you know?
Thank you all for coming out tonight. I strongly encourage you to buy Heartberries. It is an astonishing memoir.
Thank you so much.
I even say so.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors through the Los Angeles County Arts Commission and Errant Fox. Additional support is provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and individual Library Foundation donors. Media support is provided by KCRW 89.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.